the arrest of MacArthur Fellow and Harvard Professor Henry Louis Gates Jr. on July 16, 2009, led to a heated debate about race in this country. In his latest book, The Presumption of Guilt, The Arrest of Henry Louis Gates Jr. in Race, Class, and Crime in America, Harvard Law Professor Charles Ogletree furthers the discussion, using the incident as a lens through which to examine the complicated history of race, class, and crime. His book is published by Palgrave Macmillan. I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
How are you?
Now, most of our listeners are likely to remember the event, but could you remind us of the salient details of this case?
Sure. I think most people remember some aspects of it, but not the critical aspects. That's why I wrote the book. Professor Gates had just returned from China. He had been to visit the ancestral home of Yo-Yo Ma for a series he did on genealogy. And his door was jammed. He and the driver tried to open the door and had to force it open. He went inside, called the Harvard Real Estate Company, say, my door's broken. We sent someone up to repair it. And they said, we'll have someone in 15 minutes. As he's chatting about China and about Yo-Yo Ma, he says, wow, the repair person's here already. She says, no, it takes some time. And he looks, and there's a police officer, an ominous-looking police officer at his door. And he says, can I help you? The officer said, step outside. He says, what? I live here. Step outside. Mr. Gates was scared to death, wondering why was he asked to step outside in his own house. The officer, he said, I live here. He says, produce some identification. He gave him his Harvard University ID, which had his photograph on it. He gave him his Massachusetts driver's license, had his photograph, his address on it, et cetera. And the officer still wasn't satisfied.
Now, this comes as a bit of a surprise. Yesterday, I spoke to Claude Steele,
yep.
Who talked about the whole matter of the threat of stereotype.
Right.
But one of the ways he said that people get past that, his book is called Whistling Vivaldi.
Yes.
You whistle Vivaldi and people realize that you're not a threat. In the case of Skip Gates, he was wearing a suit and tie. He at that time, I think he had a cane as well. If I remember, he was limping the last time I saw him.
Well, not only was he limping, he's 58 years old, 150 pounds. He's been disabled since he was a child with polio. His right leg, he's had hip surgery 3 times. One leg is shorter than the other. And so he's hardly the threatening figure. And the reason it's different from Claude Steele, who's a good friend of mine, a great colleague from our Stanford days, is that he said the typical class thing that Claude said would work. Do you know who I am?
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's the version of Claude's book. And obviously the police officer didn't know who he was. In the book, I say this is a town gown problem. The police officer trying to do his job, and this prominent African-American being put back to a place that seemed unnatural to him.
Part of the problem was then that Skip Gates got upset and showed disrespect to the officer, at least in one telling of the story.
Well, I think when you say part of the problem, I'm not sure it is a problem.
Well, it's not illegal for me to say something like
that. Even beyond that, Skip Gates produces identification, right? And the officer could have done 3 things. He could have arrested him, right, if he believed he was the burglar. Solve it later. He could have said, I'm looking for burglars, and looked in the house without Professor Gates' approval. He didn't do that. He could have said, now I know this information. Thanks, Professor Gates. It's a false alarm. Or he could have said, Gates said, call the chief, the Harvard University Police. Call the chief. They know I live here. He didn't do that.
What did he do?
He stayed in his house, and Gates kept asking. Gates made one mistake, in my view. He had the legal right to do it. He says, I'm upset that you're doing this. You don't believe that I am who I am. I've given you my ID. I told you to call the Harvard University Police Chief. I'm going to file a complaint. I want your name and your badge number. That was the mistake. Why? I teach my students in 25 years at Harvard Law School. You have the right to be upset. You have the right to say you're going to file a complaint. Never say that. Look on his or her chest, and you'll see the police officer's name, and you'll see their badge number, and then file the report later. And he took it upon himself. Gates didn't take my class, obviously. Right? He didn't know. But that's the problem. And it was.
He was in the wrong department.
He was actually in the wrong department. He was in the wrong place at the right time in his house and thinking that he was safe.
So how did it end?
Well, here's the part why the book's so important. No one remembers the hero in this. It's not Sergeant Crowley doing his job. It's not Professor Gates defending his right to speak. It's Lucia Whalen, a white woman in the neighborhood who called 911. And what did she say? She says, I see them bringing suitcases. Now, in my 30-plus years of being a criminal defense lawyer, I've never had clients bring suitcases full of luggage to a burglary. Maybe take them out, but you don't bring them to look, right? But here's what she said. She says, I don't know if they lost their key. I don't know if those gentlemen live there or work there. No presumptions at all. That's completely left out. The dispatcher asked her, are they black, Hispanic, or white? And she said, one is Hispanic. Now, why is that important? In his report, Sergeant Crowley says this. The eyewitness, Ms. Whalen, told me she saw two black men with backpacks. She never said that. She never said that. And it's clear that he tried to identify himself. So we have this clash of absolutes about who's right. And Gates is, in a sense, coaxed to come outside. And when he comes outside, then the officer says there's the crime of disorderly conduct. What we do know, without dispute, he couldn't have arrested him in this single house for disorderly conduct. That's not a public crime. They're arguing back and forth.
Well, is this even a legal arrest?
No, it's not. And the charges were dismissed. Some will say it is, but in my experience and experience of others who know something about disorderly conduct, it's not. It's too much discretion. Police should have discretion, but here, this was about contempt of cop, attitude between a citizen and a police officer.
Which is not a unique situation. I suspect that we wouldn't have heard about it if this were this had to involve somebody who was quite famous.
That's the class part.
As you pointed out, he had just come back from China where he was shooting a PBS series.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what made it even more significant was not that it was just him, but remember my mentee, the President of the United States, Barack Obama, commented on it at the height of the health care press conference in the White House on July 23rd. 59 minutes on health care. It was on a roll, and then the next minute, what do you think about the arrest of Henry Louis Gates Jr., and things unraveled in a very bad way?
Well, he responded in a way that some people thought was perfectly okay, and yet it caused an uproar.
Well, the first response was that Henry Louis Gates is my friend, which was true, and I know all the facts, which was true. And then you have to be cautious about what you say next.
Well, then he said the cop acted stupidly. Well, stupidly was the word.
But think about it. He said the Cambridge police acted stupidly. That's what most people heard when you arrest a man in his own house. That's what he said. But mm-hmm. people only heard that first part of it. And that blackened him, I say in the book, because people then took that he became the black president, not the president who happens to be black, that he the black president, took the side of the black friend against the hardworking, and he is a hardworking white-collar, blue-collar police officer. And then he said another thing that was very significant that we forgot. He said, historically, blacks and Latinos have had a problem with racial profiling in America, and as a state senator in Illinois, I supported legislation to address racial profiling. Black people applauded it. Did we just hear the President of the United States say that we have a racial profiling problem in America? That's unprecedented. And I would venture to guess that it's probably the most candid expression about race that President Obama made before or since his election.
Because he has been very careful to not present himself as a black president.
Well, he's the president of all of America, and he was given a candid view. And what he said was a true dilemma in our system. But people took sides based on what they thought was not the president saying, but the black president saying it.
You chose the title, The Presumption of Guilt, for this book, because he was presumed guilty by at least the cop?
Yeah, absolutely. And here's the thing. Any lawyer would say, Ogletree, wait a minute. There is no presumption of guilt in our legal system. That's exactly right. That's why I gave this title. The presumption is a presumption of innocence. Mm-hmm. But in far too many instances, people are presumed guilty when people don't know all the facts and when they make judgments on hunches and not based on facts. And so that's the title to remind people we need to move toward the presumption of innocence and have police investigate more thoroughly, but also give police the power that they need to do their job. And Sergeant Crowley was not equipped to do what should have been done. He could have arrested him. He could have called the Harvard University police. Gates asked for that. Call the chief. They know who I am. That never happened, and that's why we are here today.
Well, there are basic procedures, and he didn't follow them. I think he acted stupidly, personally.
And now you're going to get some callers. Well, you're going to get some letters.
Oh, I'm sure. throughout the course of your representation of Professor Gates, you were contacted by an overwhelming amount of people who had been profiled themselves.
That's exactly right. There were women and men, black and white, every race, gender, age. About my son, daughter, niece, nephew, grandfather, grandson had something like this happen, not always with police. And I have a chapter that ends the book that's called 100 Ways of Looking at a Black Man, because most of the people who responded were African-American men. From looking at historically Thurgood Marshall, who was profiled in the 1930s in the civil rights case, to our Attorney General, Eric Holder, right here in New York, when he was a Columbia undergraduate, being stopped because the police said, we think there are weapons in your car. There weren't any. And he said it was the most devastating thing that's ever happened to him before. Bob Herbert, New York Times reporter, trying to hop a cab outside of his luxurious apartment here near Central Park, and the cab driver, an immigrant, locked the cab door, wouldn't let him in. Those sorts of stories tell the story about the problem of presumptions.
And it's not just African Americans. I knew a Mexican psychology professor who was teaching at UCLA, and he was stopped by the police regularly when he was jogging through Palos Verdes, the affluent neighborhood he lived in.
Right, right.
Well, they just assumed that he was running from having robbed somebody.
Well, let me tell you, the last thing I added to the book and had my publishers hold it was the Bill 1070 out of Arizona, what I call the new racial profiling bill, because I said, you know, I wanted people to see how broad this is. And I don't blame the police. But now in Arizona, he or she's going to look at somebody and say, ah, that's an undocumented worker. Ah, that's an Arizonan. How will he or she know? The way they look, their accent, their clothes, we just don't know. And it puts the police in the awkward position of trying to exercise discretion, but it makes all of us subjected to assumptions about who we are and what we're doing, which have nothing to do with the law.
But don't situations like this actually open up the floodgates and you wind up with, for example, Governor Brewer, Jan Brewer of Arizona, made a claim. I can't remember what the percentage was. I think it was like 95% of all of the illegal aliens are actually drug mules, she said. And there was a big uproar about that. But she said, well, they're being brought over by people who are involved in the drug trade, and they're being asked to carry the drugs. Well,
you don't solve a problem by creating a larger problem. And that's what it is, a presumption that people, because of the way they look, are part of criminality. You can't do that. You have to have some indication. I'm talking about
But then people line up on both sides, and that's where this debate became interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Then suddenly you started hearing all sorts of things that were critical of Professor Gates, despite the fact that in the end maybe he said some silly things as part of the process. But he was being arrested in his own house.
Right, but they were critical. Why? That's why I talk about class. Who does he think he is? Mm-hmm. Right? He's the uppity black who can say, and he did say, do you know who I am? Do you know who you're messing with? He said all those things. He has the right to say them. That's the problem. How do we separate these problems and making sure that we defend police, defend their right to be heard, and also defend citizens' right? We can balance liberty and security. I don't think we have to give up one to have the other. I think we can have both of them.
And we're seeing that debate now with Muslims.
That's exactly right. And I talk about that as well in the book.
Charles Ogletree is the Jesse Klimenko Professor of Law at Harvard Law School and the founding and executive director of the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice. And he has written a book called The Presumption of Guilt, The Arrest of Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Race, Class, and Crime in America. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. Stay with us for more. I want to remind you about our listener contest judged by our word maven, Patricia T. O'Connor. We're asking you to take pictures of signs that don't make sense, whether they misspell or misuse a word, have bad grammar, or put punctuation in the wrong place, and then go to our show page to submit your photo by Friday, July 16th. Pat will select her favorites, and then we'll reveal the winners on Wednesday, July 21st. For more information and some inspiration, go to our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We're back with Charles Ogletree, his book, The Presumption of Guilt, The Arrest of Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Race, Class, and Crime in America. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. You also write about Rodney King and Latasha Harlins, but those are very different kinds of situations.
And that's what I
they?
Say, too. If you read the book, and I think people mistakenly say he compares Gates' arrest to Rodney King's beating, I don't. I say that I wrote a book 16 years ago called Beyond the Rodney King Story, An Investigation of Police Conduct in Minority Communities. Nobody bought it. Nobody read it. Well, my wife read it, right? Nobody else bought it or read it. And we talked about recommendations.
I skimmed it.
Well, you can still get a copy now because it's very cheap, 52 cents on remainders. But it was outlining the problems that we have because there was a lot of frustration there. And I use it as an example to say we have been here before. in trying to figure out why there's such a bad relationship between communities and police, and this is how we can solve it.
You write about W.E.B. Du Bois and the Talented Tenth, but yes. He said that race would be the major American issue of the 20th century. Has it continued into the 21st?
Yes, he was prescient. He told us when we would recognize it, but the reality is that it continued. And I'll say this. We've made a lot of progress. We have a black president. We have a black attorney general. We have black CEOs and presidents of universities and people who are involved in education and public service. So it's phenomenal. But Gene Rivers, a friend of mine, said this when we talked about this last summer. He says, we should celebrate the fact that we have President Obama in the White House. That's a sign of America's progress. But we have one black man in the White House. We have 1 million black men in jail. So we have not solved the problem yet, and we have to continue to work at it to make sure that we can not just call ourselves post-racial when we solve one problem and another one's glaring at us in every single moment.
The highest percentage of any group in jail is African-American.
And not only that, we've gone from 1 million people in jail in 1989 to over 2 million in 2009 and approaching 2.5 million. So it's a problem, but it's a particular problem, the same group, undereducated, unemployed, less health care. So it's multiplied in other aspects of our society.
One of the reasons given by a guest I had on the show recently is that at least in some states, it became an extension of slavery, actually. After the Civil War, cheap labor was found another way, and that was to make arrested people work at jobs the equivalent of the plantation. In a couple of cases, like Angola, it is a converted plantation.
Right, and the sort of indentured servitude, which had some rights, but in fact there are many people who – and we saw in Tulia, Texas, people who were being prosecuted for crimes they didn't commit. But the labor aspects are phenomenal when you see so many people who are working for the government for no real benefit and then can't come out and get a job. They can work, 16 hours in prison, but can't find a job where they can work for minimum wage in the communities anywhere because of their record, even though we should say they can paint a fence, they can cut some grass, they can do a number of things to be productive, wage-earning, tax-paying citizens. We need to have a system that addresses that.
You talked about the election of Barack Obama, and some have argued that it signals the end to racism in America or that we're in a post-racial situation. Is that possible?
I hope it is possible. I do hope there is a time, and some people disagree with me, that we won't be, I should say, focused on race unless we focus on it as a positive aspect of our diverse culture. As Thurgood Marshall said, who's been, criticized and caricatured in these confirmation hearings of Elena Kagan, my colleague, he said we shouldn't focus on the melting pot to get rid of diversity. We should focus on the salad bowl. Why? Because in the salad bowl we have lettuce, tomatoes, cucumbers, carrots, and they can be all part of a salad. And they can also have their distinct culture, their distinct contributions. And that's why we need to see that there's a benefit in having people there. You and I would have different experiences walking out of this building right now trying to get a cab. I'm in a suit, you're not, right? They're not going to look at how we're dressed. They're going to see, and these are largely immigrants. They're going to see our face. Where is that guy going with the dark skin? Where is this guy going that doesn't have the dark skin? That's a problem we have to overcome.
They might be disappointed. I'll be going to Brooklyn, and then they have to find a fare back.
That's exactly right.
Most of the people who wrote to you really didn't get satisfaction after they had their experience. Are there any instances in which a victim of racial profiling has fought back and actually changed the way that the police conducted their work?
Absolutely. If you look at Chapter 5 of the book, one of my former students, Robert Wilkins, was a Harvard law graduate. He worked at the same office I worked at when I was a law graduate at the D.C. Public Defender Service. He was coming from his grandfather's funeral in Chicago, coming through Maryland. The police pulled over his cousin's car with him and his uncle and aunt in it and said, we want to search your car for drugs. Robert said, why? He says, well, we're going to do it, and the sooner you let us do it, the sooner you can go. He said, we don't have any drugs. This is illegal. He said, well, we don't care. And they searched his car, interior and exterior. And Robert was first fuming. He was upset. And then he went to his office and said, I can't tolerate this. He called the Maryland ACLU, the Maryland NAACP, and filed a lawsuit against racial profiling. And it took 8 years, but he was ultimately paid a hefty sum. Lawyers were paid. And Maryland said, we will no longer use this racial profiling, drug courier profile. Black people, rental cars on the highway, that's what all we need, not evidence of a crime. And that seems satisfactory. And then 8 years later, Robert finds out they're doing some of the same things. 75% of the people they were stopping are African-American, even though they're only 17% of the population on that and that highway. That's the kind of disparity. And he won, and we start talking about driving while black. Johnny Cochran, because of the noise made by Reverend Al Sharpton, represented four Latino and African-American men in New Jersey who were put over and shot at and injured. And they won a $12.95 million judgment settlement in the case. Abner Luima here, Damanu Diallo here, Sean Bell here, Oscar Grant, with the police officers on a trial that Oakland just shot and killed him last year, and his daughter received a $1.5 million judgment. So it keeps happening.
So what do the police say is the reason? Because in the end, that's where they get most of their arrests?
Well, one feeds the other, right? If you say, well, when I stop people of a certain color, that's going to make it possible. And I talk about this in criminal law. I tell students, well, the drug courier profile is simple. It's people who buy tickets with cash or a check or a credit card, right? And people who have a lot of luggage or no luggage or a small amount of luggage, people who walk fast through the place or walk slowly, people who fly from a drug-infested city or to a drug-infested city or over a drug-infested city, right? It means nothing. And but it reinforces the psychological sense that we've got the right person, and they're often wrong.
What was your view of the beer summit that President Obama arranged? Was that an adequate approach or
response? I applaud the president for trying to resolve this, because he did try to resolve it, and he talked about some problems that we have. And there's a classic photograph in the book that people may recall. Two white guys, two black guys, President Obama and Vice President Joe Biden, Sergeant James Crowley and Professor Gates, two black guys, two white guys having a beer. What could be more of a kumbaya moment? We've solved it. Get it off the agenda. The problem, if you look at the photograph that we have, is that the only mug that's full is Joe Biden's. Why? The president hadn't thought about it when he invited him out. Joe Biden doesn't drink beer. He doesn't drink anything, right? And so Joe's there regaling and at the conversation, but he's not a part of the dialogue because the president kicks him out after the photo is taken to have the conversation. So what it did is we get the focus back on health care and off of a beer summit, and now we have a health care plan, we have a stimulus package, we have some progress, but it really was interrupting what was a very effective presidency the first half of 2009.
Some people would argue differently, but that's your view.
Right.
Could and should President Obama be doing more to combat racial profiling and discrimination within the justice system, or would there be such a strong backlash that he would be perceived as pushing too hard? We've seen that when some politicians have pushed for gay rights.
Well, he's doing it right now, actually. I think when he asked the Attorney General to Eric Holder to take a look at what's happened in Arizona, that's dealing with racial profiling. And there's a federal investigation of that. I think that's very important and very timely, and I think that's going to be good. So I think that idea that the government has powers to make sure that all its citizens are treated fairly by government is a step in the right direction.
Well, how much can legislation really change when it comes to something like racism and racial profiling or ethnic profiling?
Well, we know it didn't go as far as we'd hope in Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, right? The law said that people were going to be desegregated, going to schools without regard to race, and whites fled out of those black neighborhoods, and blacks who had the resources, black middle class, fled and went to the suburbs. So sometimes you can change the law, but you can't change the minds, as I say again in this book, of people who are set upon having an existence that separates them from a larger community and doesn't see the problem of the community as part of their challenge as well.
Does Professor Gates see this as past him?
He does. He's in Haiti now. He just got back from Brazil doing another series of documentaries on genealogy and other issues. He and Sergeant Crowley met and had a beer just among the two of them at Rivers Gods in Cambridge this past year. So Sergeant Crowley gave him the handcuffs used to arrest him. Gates donated those to the Smithsonian. It's another class issue. People weren't enthusiastic about Gates giving away the handcuffs to the Smithsonian. They're saying, you're not Gandhi. You're not a martyr. You're not a revolutionary. Why should we go to the Smithsonian to see your handcuffs? But it at least tells you that his point, let's move beyond it and not get stuck with it. And it's a good man. We disagree on everything from reparations to criminal justice issues, but he's my dear friend, and I'm glad that he's safe and secure, and hope this won't happen again.
Charles Ogletree will be speaking with Soledad O'Brien tonight at the 92nd Street Y. That's at 8 o'clock. Ticket information is on our show page at WNYC.org. His latest book, The Presumption of Guilt, The Arrest of Henry Louis Gates, Jr. and Race, Class, and Crime in America. It is published by Palgrave Macmillan. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Such a pleasure and such an honor. Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, Grammy Award-winning composer-songwriter Jimmy Webb performs live in our studios. And then Thomas Fleming talks about the 50th anniversary of his book about Bunker Hill, Now We Are Enemies. Also, we'll take a look at the Boston Post Road and how it changed U.S. history, plus our latest underreported segment. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Neeschick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Theo DeCastri, Johanna Barr, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. We'll see you back here at noon tomorrow.